It has been 1 year since we started using the upper room for Reformation Society meetings. 1 year. 20 years ago this month, we moved into Livingston House. So Frontline's been here 20 years. But far more significant than that is that 56 years ago, Rhodesia declared its independence on the 11th of the 11th. And you see we've got the flags out today. In fact, you might have seen on the flagpole as it came in, we've got the Rhodesian flag flying. The 11th of November is important for many other reasons too. The First World War ended at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 1918. The guns fell silent from the worst war in history. The Memorial Order of the Tin Hats was founded in Durban, in Fort Street, Durban, in the old fort. And the Memorial Order of the Tin Hats is particularly to be a fellowship of those who survived the war, those who had been in combat, therefore the Tin Hat. And the motto of the Moths is, at the going down of the sun in the morning, we will remember them. The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Many countries have tombs of the unknown soldier because in the wars it was so horrific. More than 80% of the casualties in the First World War died from artillery fire. And that is why you go to many of these war cemeteries, they don't have graves for most of the people. They have names on the walls. When I've gone to Ypres, there are 150-odd war cemeteries within a 10-kilometer radius of Ypres for the British and Commonwealth troops alone. I read 65 Hammond's names on the walls of just six cemeteries I went to, the biggest ones, mind you, around Ypres, and the Commonwealth and War Graves Commission informed me that 480 Hammonds died in the First World War. For those who did not have a grave, they had a tomb for the unknown soldier. Every 11th of November, or closest Sunday to it, there will be, throughout the English-speaking world in particular, memorial services for those who died, not only in the First World War, but in the Second and all other wars since. Now, in Cape Town, we have an extraordinary, wonderful call to prayer. It's the Noonday Gun. I don't know how many people know that the Noonday Gun is a call to prayer. But during the First World War, Sir Percy Fitzpatrick, he is the one made famous by Jock of the Bushrod, the author of Jock of the Bushrod, the owner of Jock of the Bushrod, if you can use that word, or Jock of the Bushrod's human pet. Sir Percy Fitzpatrick, who at that time was a member of Parliament, communicated to the King of England, King Henry King George V, what Cape Town was doing. In Cape Town, here you see Adderley Street, at the Noonday Gun, throughout the war, there would be, and this was from 1916 on, that when the Noonday Gun sounded, there would also be a bugler sounding last post at Green Market Square. And everyone had to stop for 3 minutes. Every vehicle stopped, everyone stopped where they were going, and if you're at work, you had to stand by your desk in silence. And for 1 minute, remember those who had died, the other, praise God for those who had survived, and then pray for those left behind who had lost loved ones. And when this was communicated to King George V by Sir Percy Fitzpatrick, he recommended that the Empire consider emulating Cape Town's example. And this is what was done in 1919. In 1919, at the first anniversary of the end of the First World War, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, King George V ordered all in the Empire to observe a noonday pause for 2 minutes. Remember those who died and to pray for those who had lost those in the war. And during the Second World War, this practice of the Noonday Gun was continued, and prayers for those who are fighting in the wars. So this has got a long memory, and the Noonday Gun is a call to prayer to this day. I don't know how many Cape Townians know that. So where do the poppies come in? Flanders fields in France and much of Belgium are covered in poppies, and where hundreds of thousands of soldiers died, some of the bloodiest battlefields in the world. Poppies grew out afterwards, and so it started to be practiced in the 1920s to distribute these red flowers in memory of those who had died in the wars. There are memorials all over the world for those who died in that horrific war. And every 11th of November, there are wreaths that are laid. This verse you will see at many of the cemeteries around the world and on many a grave. Greater love hath no one than this, than one laid down his life for his friends. True love is measured by sacrifice. And that's often referred to as the supreme sacrifice. Well, Rhodesians participated in the First and Second World Wars in record numbers. In fact, no part of the British Empire contributed more men, percentage to its small population, than Rhodesia did. Rhodesia was very enthusiastic to the extent that the Rhodesian government had to institute laws to keep some of the men home, to keep essential services going, because they all wanted to volunteer and go off to fight. My father was in the 8th Army, North Africa, Bombardier, running a 25-pounder. He's involved in the Battle of El Alamein and fighting in Italy as part of the 8th Army under Field Marshal Montgomery. Well, Rhodesians played a key role, especially in the Air Force. And if you look at the older Rhodesian flag, you'll see the blue ensign. It's because it's Air Force blue. Because Rhodesia was a major contributor to the Royal Air Force. The Royal Rhodesian Air Force played a significant role, and Ian Douglas Smith, who was destined to become Rhodesia's Prime Minister, fought all 6 years of the war in the Royal Rhodesian Air Force, much of that in North Africa and in Italy. He was shot down in northern Italy. He had a hideous crash in North Africa where horribly disfigured his back, they feared was broken, but as he put in his book, it was merely buckled. Half of his face was burnt up, and his plastic surgery. And it's interesting that the British press would mock Ian Smith's slightly distorted facial features and his glass eye. But of course, he earned that fighting for Britain. Very ungrateful people. They would not allow the Rhodesians or the South Africans to take part in the war memorials, including for the Battle of Britain, which Ian Smith and his compatriots had played a role. The pettiness of the British government towards those who had faithfully served them was extraordinary. We had thought that we fought for them, they would fight for us, one for all for one, that sort of thing. But after Rhodesians fought in the First World War, in the Second World War, in the Korean conflict, in Malaya, here's a picture of Ian Smith after being shot down in Italy, northern Italy. He was 5 months behind the lines, operating with the partisans, and he later hiked barefoot over the Alps to rejoin Allied forces in France. Here's the Rhodesian contingent marching past the royal family in London in 1945, and you can plainly see the unique Rhodesian hats and the Queen Mother, who then was the Queen, particularly congratulating some Royal Rhodesian Air Force candidates. The King of England particularly went out of his way to thank Rhodesians who had fought in the First World War during a visit in 1947, when my father had the opportunity of catering for the royal family at Victoria Falls Hotel, where he is the catering manager. Malayan conflict came. People were exchanging their school blazers for going off to war, heading off to the Far East in Malaya, where C Squadron was formed. And to this day, C Squadron is an open orbit at the British SAS Hereford. They'll have Alpha, Bravo, Delta, Echo, but C Squadron is open in memory of Rhodesia. C Squadron will always be Rhodesian. And when the British were talking about contingency plans for the British to invade Rhodesia over UDI in 1965, a whole lot of military people said, forget it, it won't happen. And the British SAS particularly said, under no circumstances are you kidding. There's no way we will fight against our brethren who fought next to us in Malaya. Some of the Rhodesians involved in the Malayan conflict. And so, it was at the most solemn hour of the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 1965, that Rhodesia decided to declare its independence. And Britain was more outraged over the timing of it than over the fact of Rhodesia's declaration of independence. Rhodesia chose, deliberately chose, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month to declare its independence in 1965 to remind the British, we fought for you multiple times at great sacrifice. and you are betraying us. You're stabbing us in the back. They'd happily handed over countries like Kenya to cannibals like Kenyatta of the Mau Mau terrorists. Happy to hand over Nyasaland to Hastings Banda, president for life. Zambia to Kenneth Kaunda, socialist humanist. But they weren't willing to let Rhodesia have its independence, even though Rhodesia had always been self-sufficient. Rhodesia had never taken a penny of British money. Rhodesia had been self-supporting, self-governing, self-defending from the very beginning. Rhodesia was the only part of the British Empire that never took anything from the home country, in fact, only gave to them. And so the British government was ballistic with fury over the fact that this is now we're talking about Harold Wilson, who has been exposed since to have been a KGB operative all along. So Harold Wilson, Prime Minister of Britain at the time, was another one of these people that was actually working for the KGB. And that's no longer a conspiracy theory, that's been proven. Once the Soviet files were open, Old Man was his designation in the KGB files. He was a KGB agent of influence, just as Sir Roger Hollis, who was running British MI6, was also working with the KGB. So the real M that James Bond, if he was a real person, was getting his instructions from throughout all the time in the 60s and so on, 50s, 60s, into the 70s, was actually working for the KGB. Sort of wrecks the narrative of those films, does it not? We have a copy of the Rhodesian Declaration of Independence just behind the screen here on the wall, and the signature of Ian Smith. And this is how the Cape Argus reported it that day, independence declared by Rhodesia. All ties with Britain gone. Independence bell. As Ian Smith said, we have struck a blow for Christian civilization, for justice. And the Springbok Legion in London published this, reminding the British that Rhodesians had died for Britain. And now Britain was supplying arms and information to the terrorists. At the beginning, the terrorists who were attacking Rhodesia were not using AK-47s, they were using Thompson machine guns, Lee Enfields, Sten guns, Mills grenades, Webley revolvers, things supplied by Britain through the Zambian government. And so this is the flag Rhodesia actually declared independence under. The blue ensign reminding us of Rhodesia's unique role in the air war, in the Royal Rhodesian Air Force. There was a time that Ian Smith was declared to be the most hated man in Africa. Funny, he's very loved and respected now. 1970, the green and white was raised in Cecil Square in Salisbury, and Rhodesia was a republic. Now, the reason why Rhodesia had to declare itself a republic was, sadly, because the Queen allowed herself to be manipulated by her very foolish or wicked advisers into interfering in Rhodesia's politics. When a country's at war and you have people, for example, doing arson attacks, there must be consequences. People were being attacked at night by arson, and so the law in Rhodesia was passed. Anyone involved in arson, sentenced to death. The Queen routinely pardoned all the terrorists sentenced to death in Rhodesia, and so it couldn't continue with Rhodesia being a constitutional monarchy where Rhodesia was independent from the British government but still owed allegiance to the Crown. If the Crown was going to interfere with pardoning people who were sentenced to death for capital crimes, then how on earth would Rhodesia be able to fight this war? And so very reluctantly, and my father was one of the ones who opposed this. My dad was such a monarchist, he is real Rhodesian, but he's such a monarchist, to him it was grievous that we had broken with the Crown. But I think most of us in Rhodesia saw that we didn't have much choice at that stage. You can see the gold pick axe, the miners, the green for the fields, for agriculture, the red lion, the proteas, the sable antelope, the Zimbabwe bird, and may she be worthy of her name in Latin. So Rhodesia has a great heritage, a young country, but it was a magnificent country. Magnificent roads, magnificent countryside, absolutely spectacular sunsets, just absolutely a paradise for wildlife. Some of the most, this is the Eastern Highlands, the Vumba, and massive herds of elephants. I saw herds of 400 elephants in Wanki. The first rule of the road in Rhodesia was elephants have right of way. And it makes sense. Elephants do have right of way, and I don't think anyone should argue with that. A female elephant can be 6 tons, a male elephant 8 tons or more. And some of them a lot more than that. There's one of the big tuskers. And Rhodesia, of course, is also known as a place of mystery, King Solomon's mines, the gold of Ophir, Zimbabwe ruins, the pioneers, the eastern highlands. You can see the Portuguese conquistadors here. The first Europeans to come into what later became Rhodesia were Portuguese conquistadors who came to Monomotapa. Interesting story. Almost all of them died of malaria, actually. Hundreds of these Portuguese conquistadors in their armor coming into Rhodesia almost 500 years ago. This is Fort Victoria, and in fact, that tower still stands. That was the original tower for the original camp at Fort Victoria, now Masvingo. And the Matabele, I was brought up in Matabele land. Rhodesia is a wonderful place. Also well known for agriculture, tobacco farming, Taganda tea, phenomenal farming efficiency. You can kind of see the kind of farms that they had in Rhodesia, and showing advance in plowing and tractors and stamps just explains where Rhodesia used to export food. Some great books produced. In fact, the Scouts were founded from the inspiration Rhodesia. The founder of the Scouts, Major Baden-Powell, later General Baden-Powell, said that he modeled his idea of the ideal Scout on the Rhodesian British South Africa Police, Mounted Police, and particularly on the Scouts involved in the Shangani Patrol. Many great, interesting books that we would have had at that time. And strip roads, this is something pretty unique to Rhodesia. This was a vast country with very few taxpayers. You'd have these thin strips of tar, and you could travel for a long time without seeing another car. But when you saw another car, you had to move your left wheel off. Your right wheel could be on the left side, so that the other car would do the same on the opposite side. You'd wave excitedly as you passed another car, then you get back onto the strip road. It just meant that motorbikes had one strip, but to be honest, trucks didn't always give us that chance. How many times had to pull off into the dirt because a truck was still coming towards us? This was, as many called it, God's own country. We didn't only have zebra crossings, we had giraffe crossings too. And wonderful, tallest animals in the world. Magnificent creatures. Where in the world could you have a giraffe in your swimming pool? Except in Rhodesia. And Birchenhof Bridge and Makuti, middle of everywhere. And you can see, only 3,000 kilometers from Cape Town and so on. The Rhodesian stamps, of course, reflected all the way along that we were under the crown, and the Queen's image was on our stamps for a very long time. This kind of gives you a good idea of South African Airways, Rhodesian. You know, okay, South Africa was the big brother. Rhodesia, nice little Viscounts and Dakotas, DC-3s. But while South Africa was the big neighbor, the big brother, I remember getting on the planes in Rhodesia. There was no security. We walked straight onto tarmac, straight up the stairs into the plane, and there the stewardesses, and we had stewardesses there, not flight attendants. The stewardess would say, please ensure that your rifles are on safe and securely stored in the overhead compartments, and that your pistols are holstered and on safe. And no Rhodesian airline ever got hijacked for some reason. What airlines have cheetahs as their mascots? And just look at these prices. You could have literally a 5-day stay at, including the flights at Victoria Falls, for $79 and things like that, you know, all expenses covered. Just amazing what you could do. You could get a 3-course steak meal in 1977 for $2. In fact, the Rhodesian dollars were stronger than the American dollars and the British pound. Victoria Falls, one of the 7 natural wonders of the world. Absolutely magnificent. First mapped out by David Livingstone, a full mile wide, 1,700 meters wide, 310 feet high. Phenomenal, as David Livingstone said, angels at creation much have gazed in wonder at such sight. Here's a Livingstone Island. David Livingstone beach this canoe here, crawl to the edge, and, yep, to the edge. And he let down a weighted rope, measured out 310 feet. And that's what it is. We haven't been able to improve it. How do you like that idea of crawling to the edge of that? And so, on the centenary of David Livingstone discovering Victoria Falls, this magnificent, probably the best known, most famous image of David Livingstone was unveiled on the 16th of November, 1956. And that's on the centenary of his discovering, mapping, sighting, naming, making known to the world, Victoria Falls. And this is the classic image of David Livingstone, which you can see so superior to the kind of monuments and statues that are produced today. Well, it's been a joy to go there many, many times, taking Calvin up there, looking across at the frontier, getting soaked at Victoria Falls, Mushi Oya Tanya. Well, Rhodesia had magnificent nature, the rainbow always over the falls, at Victoria Falls at night, Lake Kariba. One of the most amazing achievements, this was showing the way for hydroelectric electricity all over Africa. And Kariba produced more electricity back in the 1960s than the whole of Zimbabwe produces now. And the population is 10 times the size it was back in 1960. And it was the cheapest electricity anywhere in the world. Absolutely efficient, clean energy, phenomenal. And we looked at that particularly last year on the 60th anniversary of Victoria Falls. Our wildlife, magnificent herds of buffalo, tremendous amounts of every kind of tremendous animal. I think one of the highlights of my life was going to Wanke Game Reserves, Mushindak Game Reserves, seeing the different great creatures, waking up to the sound of a fish eagle while camped on the side of Victoria Falls, and experts around the world praised Rhodesia for its wildlife conservation, some of the greatest nature conservation in the world. I had a bush baby as a pet at one stage, lovely pet, wonderful for nocturnal people like me, slept all day, played all night. And of course the cheetahs. And, yep, magnificent animals, great creatures, large, medium and small. And in Kariba, the hippopotamuses. Hippos have right of way in the water in particular. You should not argue with a hippo at all. They do have some serious teeth. And they can be quite grumpy. And you've got to be very quick when a croc comes out. I've actually stepped on a crocodile in Zimbabwe. I thought it was a log. And when it started to move, I did some kind of gymnastics backflip. It's amazing where you find that ability to jump from when you have the log under your move. Just such great creatures, wonderful, wonderful opportunities. And you see they've got day spas in nature, we see cooperation nature, and all kinds of amazing creatures. This 5 meter long crocodile, you see the size of the rodent, you see the size of the warthog in the mouth. You don't want to argue with these chaps. And Calvin and I have actually swum in a river where they said it, there was a 5 meter crocodile. We learned afterwards. Leopards, stealthy, silent, fast, unbelievably strong. And these are the ultimate survivors. You may not see the leopard, but as the game ranger said to me at my first bush survival school, the leopard will see you. And that is a fact. As for the lions, well, lions have right of way. And they can sleep wherever they want. And so Rhodesia had the most wonderful wildlife sanctuary. It was magnificent to grow up in a country where you were safer in a war than you are at peace now today in Cape Town. We had just such wonderful opportunities to grow up in a country where there's such wildlife. I could see all kinds of wildlife just walking outside of the city limits of Bulawayo, not going to game park. And at school, I remember my main goal in life was to become a game ranger that I could shoot poachers and protect animals. Zimbabwe ruins, mysterious, extraordinary, great place to explore. When people first came across it, they began to wonder, could this have been King Solomon's mines? All sorts of books have been written about it. But the Rhodesians turned the wilderness into paradise. Literally, just with the fountains flowing in what used to be thornbush wilderness. And extraordinary how just in a few years, they produced magnificent advanced cities such as Salisbury, Bulawayo. I'd walk to school down jacaranda-lined trees, could walk in the shade, popping the jacaranda bulbs on the way, and just have carpets of these beautiful flowers. After independence in 1980, Tekeri in Parliament said that all jacaranda trees should be chopped down because they're remnants of colonialism. To this, P.K. van der Bijl said, "Mealy meal, rifles, and clothes are also remnants of colonialism." He had a point. Matopo's Leopard Rock Hotel in the Bumba, this is in the Eastern Highlands near Umtali, and warthogs. These warthogs, we used to see them all over the place in hotels in Rhodesia because, as my father explained, the warthogs are expert gardeners. They trim the grass perfectly. And so you put the warthogs on the lawn, and without the need for lawn mowers and so on, they keep the grass trimmed. And great people to have on staff. You may wonder why Rhodesia's coins used to have a hole in the middle. It's so that they could be put through a string and people could wear them around their neck, that they've got their money on hand, because many of the people didn't have pockets, and so this was just a convenient way of people carrying money, which was a thoughtful way of doing it. And by the way, you could buy a lot with a penny. And 10 shillings was really serious money. And this was real money. With $1, what you could do with a dollar. So, for example, matinee cinema, 20 cents on Saturday morning. Popcorn, 4 cents. Coke, I think that was 4 or 5 cents. And you could get 4 chappies for 1 cent. You could get a whole Airfix box of soldiers or a tank or aircraft to put together and paint and so on for 55 cents. So, you know, with $1, you could do a lot. I mean, obviously, you see my priorities at that stage. At $2, I mean, this is real money. People don't understand how much has been stolen from all of us by the debasing of our currency, a devaluing of currency, which is a hidden tax. This is the largest currency in Rhodesia, $10. This $10 could buy you vastly more than a $100 trillion note in Zimbabwe could in 2008. In fact, in 2008, a $100 trillion note in Zimbabwe, which is after they'd already deducted 16 zeros off the currency, couldn't buy half a loaf of bread, a $100 trillion note. But $10, you could buy a lot with $10. Mermaid's Pool. We didn't have Disney World. We didn't have Rutunga Junction. We had Mermaid's Pool. Things built in nature that you could just have such a lot of fun from. And this was the kind of paradise that people brought up in Rhodesia. We remember great missionaries like Dr. Robert Moffat, one of the first to preach the gospel in Madibele land, and hunters like Frederick Salu, who was recruited by Cecil John Rhodes to be the guide for the British Antarctic Column. Well, there's a link between Cape Town, Rhodesia, and that's Cecil John Rhodes. Cecil John Rhodes belongs to Cape Town, Rhodesia, and Kimberley, also Oxford, and Bishop Stortford, where he comes from. But probably nobody ever did more for the people of Cape Town than Cecil John Rhodes. He bought up the whole of the side of Table Mount to protect Newlands Forest and all areas through to Constantinople from logging, development, and habitation. Preserved it for the people for the future. Kirstenbosch Gardens is a gift from Cecil Rhodes to the people of the Cape. He ensured that legislation was enacted to protect Rondebosch Common from any commercial development. It is for the people of Cape Town as a whole to be kept in its natural state. He never took a salary. How about that? A politician who didn't take a salary. In fact, not only did he not get people to build him a house, he built for the skewer and donated it to people of Cape for future prime ministers. I've asked many a people who don't like Cecil Rhodes, name me one person in the history of Cape Town who did more for the people of Cape Town than Cecil John Rhodes. Name me another politician who didn't take a salary but actually donated things to the people of the country. I'm racking my brains and I think I know a fair amount of history, but I can't think of a second. And Rhodesia at that time was under the control of Madibele. Cecil John Rhodes, by hook and by crook and by negotiation and scheming, managed to get Queen Victoria to give them the charter to be able to send the column in, and they negotiated and got the agreement of King Lubengula of the Matabele, gave them thousands of rifles, gave them a whole lot of different things like the boats on the Zambezi and what have you, and in exchange he got mineral rights to the country, and in they came, the column, all the way up to Mashonaland, which Lubengula was happy to give him because that was the land of his vassals, the slaves, the Shona, who were under Matabele control. They raised the British South Africa Company flag. We've got an example right here on the side of a smaller version of that flag. It's a Union Jack, and in the middle it's got the British South Africa Company logo with the line. This was the actual flag raised over Fort Salisbury back in 1890. And very soon, Salisbury was being developed all over the country, developments. Here's Salisbury in 1898. This is just 8 years after the pioneers arrived, and already you can see the beginnings of quite a settlement. And everything had to be transported by ox wagon. And these are the inhabitants in particularly Matabele land and the Matopas area. Some of the volunteers, these are farmers, miners, coming to volunteer on parade. Improvised fort set up. You can see the Maxim machine gun in the foreground. And the little about 4-pounder. The kind of woman who went up there must be an extremely hardy pioneers. It was a tough, rough, and very wild country at that time. And the Matabele were known as ferocious fighters. And so these are some of the people who settled it. You can see the man in the foreground is Frederick Selu, after whom the Selu Scouts were named later. One of the most famous of the scouts of that time. You can imagine just to travel or to deliver post was quite a dangerous thing at that time, and there were many fights, lagers, battles, including Major Alan Wilson and the Alan Wilson Patrol, the Shangani Patrol, who fought to the last man. Quite an incredible story. They're fighting the Matabele, and they ended up across the Shangani River during a rainstorm. The rainstorm flooded the river. They couldn't get back. They were encircled by thousands of Matabele. There were only 40 of them there, and they stood and they fought. And after hours of fighting, the Matabele saluted them and said, "You are free to go, you brave men. You can take your wounded weapons, you can leave." And Alan Wilson said, "We do not retreat." So they were saluted again, they fought to the end. And after this, the Matabele, who had just killed them all, came into Bulawayo and surrendered. And their answer to Leander Starr Jamieson, the same Leander Starr Jamieson that Jamieson Hall is named after, the Jamie Shuttle. When Jamieson said, "Why are you retreating? Why are you surrendering? You've just won a victory." He said, "These men fought like lions. They were men of men, and the fathers were men before them. If these young men could fight like lions, what will happen when their fathers come for revenge? We want peace now." And so it's the one time I know in history where a lost battle won a war. Never underestimate the power of courageous standing to do your duty. And so, by order of Cecil Rhodes, the Shangani Patrol was reinterned on World's View in the Matopas to share the same burial site as Cecil Rhodes did in 1902. Some of the original British South Africa police looked more like bandits, but later on they came to be a very professional, respectable corps. I mean, everything that could possibly be shining and polished is. And they recruited people like here in Lawsyland, Kit Inspection at Salisbury Depot, and Barotse Native Police in what is today Western Zambia on bayonet drill. You wouldn't want to argue with police like that. Now, the British South Africa Police were always a paramilitary force, very professional and ready to fight. Cecil Rhodes on the march in the field, planting, digging, laying foundations. And soon you had these stores, and I remember seeing these stores that were still around in Bulawayo when I was a young boy. And I remember this building too. It's built in 1897, but it was still around in the 1970s. Bulawayo was laid out so that you could turn an ox wagon around in Main Street. 16-span ox wagon, you could turn around. Wide streets. The stagecoaches, sort of resembles the American type of stagecoaches. Transport, absolutely key. How do you like all the big hats that people are wearing and collars and all the way down, sleeves all the way down to the, you know, I don't think you'd want to go around in the heat like that. Market day and the trains. The key vision of Cecil Rhodes was railway from Cape Town to Cairo, and Rhodesia was a key part of getting up to Cairo. And so this was one of the great advances when the railway reached Bulawayo, and then when it reached Victoria Falls. Do you know that every piece of metal in Victoria Falls Bridge was manufactured in Britain, brought out from Birmingham? And they even specified the time of day that the final middle section was to be put in place so that as the sun rose and it swelled, it would fit perfectly. And here, Victoria Falls Bridge. What a phenomenal act of engineering. And to have done this back in a time when they didn't have satellite technology and GPSs and all the different coordinates we have, and yet it fits. It worked. It took railways and it took pentechnicons, and it still stands today. And Cecil Rhodes said he wanted it close enough to Victoria Falls that as the people crossed the bridge, the spray from falls would come through the window onto their faces. And what a magnificent bridge it is. And so this great vision of Cecil Rhodes was Cape Town to Cairo. And Rhodesia was one of the paths on the way. And we have in Cape Town Gardens, Cecil Rhodes pointing north, this monument, saying your hinterland lies there. Go north, young man. And so this, I remember as a young boy in Cape Town, shortly after being converted, seeing this monument and just feeling again the confirmation of God, I must get into Africa, I must go north. Missionary vision. Of course, he was not thinking in terms of missions, but he was the son of a pastor. And if he could have used that zeal for missions and evangelism, just imagine. He used it for the empire, and for the queen, and for education. And this is what the British Empire came to look like, partly as a result of Cecil Rhodes' hard work and vision. Now, the founder of Rhodesia died in Muizenberg, in this little college in Muizenberg. And here is the funeral procession of Cecil Rhodes' body being carried up from Cape Town and buried in Wall's View on the Metropolis. You can see there was a lot of culture early on. Monuments to Ian Smith, this is close to where I lived in Bulawayo, Cecil Rhodes' monument being unveiled. But in Cape Town, we have the most magnificent of the monuments, built by public donation, no government money put into it. This is all private citizens of Cape Town paid for the construction of Rhodes Memorial. 49 steps, one for every year of his life. And the scouts and the Girl Guides and others would regularly have meetings up there, memorials, services, and I think many people have used it for training, running up and down these stairs. Many a film set has used this. The Matthew film used this for the temple, and it's a magnificent monument, and it gives you an unparalleled view of Hottentots Holland Mountains, a magnificent view of the Cape Flats and of Rondebosch Common right there. What a spectacular view. What a great venue. And I found this to be ideal in my time while I was studying. I would regularly go up to Rhodes Memorial in the afternoon to do some of my reading and separate books. I'd lie out to nature, and the deer would wander around. The deer got so comfortable with me that they would come lie next to me, and I even reached a stage of being able to have my head resting on the deer while they were lying there and reading my books and doing my studies, trying to get a bit of sunshine and be out in nature somewhat. But a great view. I remember coming out of the army and just climbing onto the top of that horse and then looking down thinking, this is a bit insane, how am I going to get down from here? But we do some strange things. Rhodes Memorial. Where else in the world do they have such views and such magnificent monuments? Rhodes Cottage is a very humble location for one of the richest men in Africa. He lived a very humble life. He did not give himself much luxury. Cecil Rhodes lived simply. In fact, it was said at the time that the lowest clerk in his company had a higher standard of living than Cecil Rhodes. He put everything into the cause, into the empire, into education, into legacy, and he died in a very humble little cottage. and this is a monument here, but it's said that the first word in Rhodesian is Rhodes, but the last word in Rhodesian is Ian. And it's interesting that Ian Smith died just a short distance down the road from where Cecil Rhodes died in Muizenberg. Ian Smith died at St. James. And so there's a link between Rhodesia and Cape Town. And the link was often covered by ox wagons before the railway. But how do you like this view of Bulawayo? What massive, magnificent, wide roads, and all part of Main Street. You won't see these two statues here anymore, Cecil Rhodes and the Pioneers Maxim machine guns monuments. But here you can see different events, cultural events, Bulawayo Dramatic Society, we actually have culture there, and the centenary commemorative altar, some of the British South Africa police, and you can see, serious looking people, mounted police. The BSAP are extremely professional, and they kept the country safe. We had such a high standard of living. Rhodesia had the lowest crime rate in the whole of Africa, and the highest literacy rate as well, and some of the best education throughout Africa, highest standards of education. And I don't know how many others have done as much work polishing boots and belts and everything else. Where else in the world do you get police who wear shorts? And these were tough police, tough terrain, British South Africa police. And I remember this, going to school, and you'd have this sort of level crossing, and the BSAP taking the school kids across busy roads. I remember seeing this as a youngster. But there was a real war going on behind to keep us safe, to be able to enjoy that paradise. Mother with her three daughters, downtown, these picnic spots, look at those old cars. The cars didn't get any newer because all the cars in Rhodesia were older than 1965 because we couldn't get any imports after 65. Bulawayo, it's City Hall, again, fountains. This is the Supreme Court or High Court in Bulawayo, Matabeleland. And this gives you an idea of the wonderful land here. This is the swimming pool in Bulawayo that I remember going to many, many times in the heat of summer. It would be this time in Rhodesia, November would be what they called suicide month. So hot. Every moment that you could, we're in a swimming pool. And this is St. Mary's and All Saints Cathedral in Salisbury, which is the site of the deafening silence speech. Rhodesian Rugby Cup, back when we could travel around the world and compete with rugby tours, 1964, the last time Rhodesia was involved in international rugby tours. At school, we got trophies for shooting. Shooting was one of the subjects at school, as was bushcraft, survival, tracking, anti-tracking. Outstanding. And we all dreamed of when we'd be old enough to don the green camouflage uniform and go and fight. My brother got to fight the Rhodesian Army. I was too young for that war. My turn came in the South African Army. But in 1975, as Portugal had a revolution, handed over Mozambique and Angola to Marxist terrorists, suddenly our whole eastern border, a full half-hour border, became hot. And then Botswana opened up to terrorists. And so Rhodesia had 85% hostile border and only one bridge, one railway line to South Africa, to a friendly country. And what we didn't know was the Rhodesian government was being blackmailed, bullied, and threatened by South Africa. The South African government and the National Party was actually bullying Rhodesia to give in to one man, one vote demands in exchange for promises made by Kissinger to South Africa. Kissinger said, you give up Rhodesia, we'll let you keep Southwest Africa. Well, you know, Kissinger's word is good for, like, nothing. You can see we've got some of these posters here of the Rhodesian Army recruitment posters and what barracks used to look like, graduating class, training. If you're scared of heights, tough, got to get over it. If you're scared of noises, also got to get over that. And here's a women's unit on training. And in the field, tracking through the swamps, this is Rex Tarr, famous, what would you call him? He is, was he a comedian?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a well-known media personality. And the Rhodesian African Rifles, absolutely superb, many of them paratroopers as well. When people depict the Rhodesian War as black against white, totally wrong. It was black and white together against red. 85% of the Rhodesian army were black volunteers. The whites were conscripted, black soldiers and police were volunteers. And the army fought together. It was an extraordinary, powerful fighting force, even though the Rhodesian army was outnumbered and out-supplied by the enemy. But isn't it wonderful having mascots like a cheetah? Rhodesian Light Infantry, the Saints, preparing for fire force, paratrooping, dropping in on the enemy. Again, Rhodesians really like their shorts, honestly. 18, 19 years old, jumping out of planes. And it takes quite a bit to jump out of a plane. And again, troops in the field in shorts. I remember my brother, he wouldn't bother to wear socks. He'd just wear boots without socks, because going in and out of rivers, it just was so much easier than getting your socks wet all the time. So it was found better not to get foot rot, to just go without socks. Fire force dropping in on top of a battle. There were such a large area, such a small army, that the helicopters would be busy going and dropping off a fire force team to hit where the terrorists were. And sometimes they could go to 5 contacts in a day. Grey Scouts, the cavalry, powerful fighting force, and Rhodesia had one of the last active cavalry units in the world. Salus Scouts, many of whom were excellent trackers, and many were ex-terrorists who had turned and come over and joined the Rhodesian side. And they fought long and hard. The enemy we fought were cowards. They used landmines. We had a powerful air force. It was small, but very effective and professional. Small helicopters. Here you can see 3 different types of helicopters, the Alouette and the Huey, and the 4 different types of bombers and fighter bombers in the Rhodesian Air Force, including the Hawker Hunter and the Canberra and the Vampires, and DC-3s. These are the workhorses. We did a lot of the resupplies of people and coming into just the Green Leader type bomber that hit the terrorist bases in Zambia. And quite an arsenal that you could fit into one of these hunters. Well, there weren't many, but what Rhodesia had were powerful and used effectively. This is one of the fighter aces. And I think that looks like the whole Rhodesian Air Force right there. We didn't have much. We had our biggest battle. There were 40 helicopters. That was a full in one battle. And that was all the helicopters in the whole Rhodesian Air Force. There was not one left in reserve for the battle on Chamoio. And, you know, this is traffic jam near Grand Reef on the way to attack terrorist base in Mozambique. Jumping out of helicopters, you know, what happens is you've got to jump out quick, because the first, every person jumps off, helicopter goes higher. Last to jump off, it's much, much, much higher. So to be the first off is actually a very good idea. You can see all kitted out. These helicopter pilots are extraordinary. What they had to do, they had to come into hot zones, under fire, for casualty evacuations, resupplies, all sorts of things. And here you can see helicopters and cavalry working together. This is one of the last of those kind of wars. And where the Rhodesian forces were outnumbered, the Special Air Service, Sea Squadron, absolutely professional, the elite, as they were called, and Sea Squadron, they managed to do some extraordinary operations across the border in Zambia and in Mozambique, attacking terrorist bases, often used AK-47s, assault rifles. One of our friends is the Coe family. Corporal John Allen Coe is an American Marine who chose to protest against America's no-win wars in Vietnam. But instead of doing a year in Vietnam, he came to Rhodesia and did 2 years fighting terrorists in Rhodesia and was killed in action in the Rhodesian War. We know his family, his brothers. We've got his books in the library, in the bookshop, from the diaries of John Allen Coe, the fighting doc. He was a fighting medic. He was killed rushing out in the open to give medical care to others who had been shot down in the middle of a hideous battle. A very brave man. 12th of November, 1975. My brother mentioned being trained by him in parachute training. And He asked John L. Craig, why are you here? You don't have to be here. This isn't your war. And he said, John L. Craig's response was, this is everyone's war. Communism, terrorism is a threat to all of us. The chaplains were few in number, but they played a vital, vital role. This is a small army of young men in shorts. As I said, be a man amongst men. But it's not like you didn't have women who were doing things that men would be afraid to do too. There are many great women in the Rhodesian army and police. And then there was the forces sweetheart, Sally Donaldson.
Yeah.
The forces favorite, messages, radio programs. And she was a voice often heard on the radio and a great encouragement, reading letters for the soldiers in the field and so on. Security was a concern. In fact, it was discovered at the end of the war, Ian Smith told me, that the head of Rhodesia Security Intelligence Service, that's the CIO, Ken Flower. Ken Flower, the head of Rhodesian Central Intelligence Organization, was a British spy who was passing on Rhodesian secrets to the terrorists, which is why every attempt to get rid of Nkomo and Mugabe failed, because the head of the Central Intelligence Organization for Rhodesia was actually working for the British, who were handing on the information to communists. So important to have good hospitals, and as I said, in the hospital, every hospital is a sanctuary, every nursing sister an angel, every patient a VIP. And when I had my first kidney stones and ended up in hospital in Bulawayo in 1972, as a 12-year-old, I was just amazed how nice the nurses made a hospital experience. It was such a fun experience being in hospital. It really was. It was extraordinary, the camaraderie, the atmosphere. It's just like the last of the Florence Nightingales running up there. This is not an unusual scene. A family with weapons ready, because the farmers were in the very, very front line. The farmers were the primary target. And so it was so important that the farmer be armed, the farmer's wife be armed. Everyone know how to shoot. I mean, with the men, at the end, the men were 6 months in a field and 6 months home. So, for example, at school, you'd have two teachers, one for half the year, but one for the other half the year, because if they're male, they'd spend half the year in the field. That it was literally 6 months a year call-up in the end for the reserves. But not unusual seeing women in the shopping centres with a revolver on the hip or a submachine gun over their shoulder. And Umtali, which is only 4 kilometres from Mozambique, came under regular artillery and rocket bombardment. This is 122mm rocket Soviet provided, fired from a B-10. And so homes in the eastern highlands of Rhodesia needed bomb shelters and trenches. And the schools came under attack. In fact, I remember a case where one young schoolboy with his 2.2 rifle fought off a whole terrorist group that's attacking the school in Umtali, and from the upper floor in the hostel, he was firing out the window at these terrorists with his 2.2. I mean, that's a crack, as opposed to the rat-a-tat of the AK. And they fled from one 12-year-old shooting a 2.2 at them. These farmers' wives had to be tough, strong, resilient, resourceful. And Rhodesia started pioneering the way with farmers' armored cars that could take the full weight of an explosion and let the occupants survive. Seeing children from farms going to school in an armored vehicle, that was not unusual. It is inadvisable to travel beyond this point after sunset. Ian Smith told me that he regularly broke his own government's laws. He would go without convoy, drive on his own, no bodyguard, nothing like that, through to his farm at Silipri. So he couldn't be bothered waiting for the convoy and things like that. For the convoys, the leading police vehicle would have one of these gun stations in the front where a chap, I mean, imagine standing in the back of a bucky and you've got the 50 cal machine gun and you're playing point man. That's a bit nerve-wracking, I would think. I'd feel a little exposed standing in the back of a bucky in a free fire zone. But this is everyone lined up waiting for the convoy. And when you lined up for the convoy, you had to wait, but apparently Ian Smith ignored it directly and just he dashed straight through. Overtaking is forbidden. Yeah, well, I would imagine that's a good reason for that. Our Salus Scouts of Rhodesian SAS C Squadron would regularly be going into Mozambique, camoing up and a ghillie suit like this, and observing and being able to advise. This is an OP, observation post. raids on communist bases in Mozambique, some of the attacks, Soviet tanks destroyed. These are just some of the finding landmines. We had some excellent tracker dogs who could lead the engineers to the landmines. Rhodesia started to invent all kinds of armored cars to transport through these areas where landmines were the national plant. And here you can see a kind of youngsters in the field. That's what we would look like after a week or so without a bath or shower or change of clothes. Grand Reef. This is where many of the helicopter fire force operations went from, just near Ontario. And that's a pretty typical scene. These are all citizens' force people. Remember, these are totally normal civilians in most of these cases. This could be everyone from the storekeeper, the local teacher, and so on. But called up for 6 months of the year to fight. And they'd often cut off the sleeves of the shoulder of the shirts, and my brother would do that too. You kind of get the feel, though, that towards the end of this war, 15-year war, there was a lot of weariness. A lot of these soldiers literally would be thrown up multiple times a day to different contacts, especially the Rhodesian Light Infantry. They were often the workforces being helicoptered in, finished one Casavac, picked up, head off to another fire force, dropped in on a hot landing strip, fight the terrorists there, be picked up, taken to another place. So we like firing. The true soldier fights not because he hates what is in front of him, but because he loves those who are behind him. Just a reminder of the war that for 15 years slowed the advance of communism. When the Cold War was at its height, Rhodesia was the hot point of the Cold War and was bearing the full weight of the Soviet Union and Red China's onslaught on Southern Africa and was fighting against all odds. Totally left alone, boycotted, abandoned, betrayed, sanctioned by its Western allies. Its only friend left was South Africa, and that was an unreliable friend, as it turned out, sadly. Ian Smith was the backbone, courageous, the first Rhodesian-born prime minister. The previous prime minister before him were born overseas and immigrated, but he was born Rhodesian. His parents were original pioneers. And Janet Smith, Ian Smith, where in the world will you see a prime minister cycling to work or walking to work? This in Jamison Avenue, and catching the train. But these were straightforward, simple people. Ian Smith was not a politician. He was a farmer. He was an airman. He was a statesman. He was concerned for his people. He didn't enrich himself. When I met Ian Smith multiple times, he always was driving himself, even during the height of the war, when he was the prime minister and Rhodesia was at war, and I heard from my father, he's coming to Bulwark Club, I'm waiting outside to see some entourage. Down the road comes a battered Peugeot 404, out steps Ian Smith, plainly recognized him, I mean, prime minister, knew his face on TV and from pictures and newspapers, and there's no bodyguard, there's no aide-de-camp, there's no chauffeur, there's not a policeman sight. He stroked my cat that's sitting on the wall, he smiled at me, walked up into Bulwark Club, and I'm looking around, where's the entourage? I didn't know prime minister could travel like that. And I mentioned to him later that I had seen 1982, 8 years later, I was in Harare, and down Samoa Michelle Avenue came sirens and police car after police car after police car, motorbike outriders, and then stretch Mercedes, both with tinted windows, you didn't know which one he's in, truckloads of gooks with rocket launchers and heavy machine guns, and that's Robert Mugabe. Every day he went to work and back and so on. This was in every car to stop on all sides, and they would shoot anyone who didn't stop. Yeah. They shot people who were deaf, who couldn't hear, things like that. Just insane. So I mentioned this to Ian Smith, and he said, I'm a lifelong Presbyterian. I fear God. I survived the Second World War. What do I need to be afraid of? He never had bodyguards. He didn't care. He wasn't interested. In fact, when he was assigned bodyguards, he'd given them the slip. And he must have been a very hard person to look after. It must have been a security nightmare for his people. He said to me that sometimes he chased everyone out of Independence. That's a prime minister's residence. There wasn't a cook in the kitchen, a policeman at the door, or the gate. The gate was open. Front door was open. Rhodesian Ridgeback lying over it. That's the way he and Janet liked it. They said, I can't bear having people fussing around me. And that was Ian Smith. His book, So now I read The Great Betrayal. Outstanding. I read that in a matter of just about 2 weeks on a speaking tour overseas. Every time I was on a plane, I was working through it. Republished later with updates. Bitter Harvest, The Great Betrayal, and The Dreadful Aftermath. An extraordinary man, farmer, and in war or peace, a fighter. Well, this is how we knew Ian Smith. In the last 20 years of his life, I would meet with him regularly for lunch, supper, prayer, Bible study, radio interviews, and we had a lot of opportunities to discuss history from a perspective of someone who fought. Ian Smith passed away in 2007 in St. James, near Cape Town. And so, Flame Relief Foundation Cape Peninsula has produced this plaque to be placed in St. James Retirement Home, the retirement home where he passed away. The Honourable Ian Douglas Smith, born the 8th of the 4th, 1919, died the 20th of November, 2007. Last Prime Minister of Rhodesia from 1964 to 1979. Born in Silukwe, Rhodesia, passed away at St. James Retirement Hotel, resting in peace at Winura Farm, Silukwe. And this is one memorial plaque that I believe, again, just reminds us of the link between Cape Town and Rhodesia. United States President Theodore Roosevelt challenged us, it is not the critic who counts. It's not the critic that counts. Nor the man who points out how the strong man stumbled. Nor where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred with dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, and spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while doing greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. And so, we have produced some photo collages in the latest Rosarian magazine. We produced the Fish Eagle magazine and the Rosarian, which are available. Just come back from the printer. We've got some here, and they're available online on the Rhodesian Association of South Africa website. Our Lord Jesus Christ said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." It's so important that we know the truth of history, that we understand the times, that we can know what God's people can do. Our mission is dedicated to winning Africa for Christ. On this 11th of November, we want to remember those who've died in the wars. We want to remember Rhodesia. We want to remember soldiers, civilians, and police who died in Rhodesia. And all over the world, there are different memorials being set up in different ways to remember the different units. We just had a memorial service in Fishhook Methodist Church last Sunday. The video of that is up on our website as well. In England, the RLI, Rhodesian Light Infantry Troopy, has been transported and is in a safe state in England. And this also has that Bible verse from John 15, verse 13. Greater love hath no man than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends. These are some famous Rhodesian history books, which are all in our Rhodesia Heritage Library here, which tell the incredible story of a battle against all odds, holding the line for Western civilization against communist terrorism, hot part of the Cold War.